Welcome to Musings from Sam Houston's Stomping Grounds, a production of the Newton Gresham Library at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas.
This is Michelle Martinez, a reference librarian at Newton Gresham Library, and I'm here interviewing Dr. Scott Kalkinen, and he's the head of the new MFA program?
Director of the MFA program in creative writing.
Okay, so let's chat. Let's talk about that. So, do you have a terminal degree?
I have technically two terminal degrees. I have an MFA from the University of Arizona in creative writing and a PhD from the University of Missouri Columbia in English with a creative dissertation.
So was the creative writing your love the whole time, or?
As a kid, or, I mean, is that what you mean by that? Or,
yeah, have you
yeah,
always?
Yeah, I mean, I dabbled in writing as a kid, you know, I was a storyteller. Given to very melodramatic kids suffering from leukemia and overcoming sort of CBS Monday Night Movie of the Week sort of stories. But then as a high school student, I mean, I read a lot. I liked books. But I had no awareness of how do you become a writer. I mean, like, how do these books come into being? And writing itself was seen more as a pragmatic skill that you had. I knew that you needed to have it to write research papers when you got to college. Mm-hmm. I knew that you needed to be able to write good business letters if you wanted to get a job or if you were going to have a job. But that was sort of the extent of it. And then books were sort of seen as escapist, right? That you just, you know, when you were lonely, you took it away from things, you would read a book. And then I had a professor in college, my freshman year at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, a guy named Jack Riddle, who was a poet. And it seemed very strange to me at the time. But he sort of flipped my world upside down. And the way he did that was by sort of changing my relationship to literature and what literature was, what creative writing was, the notion that it was a way of exploring the world and answering questions, or asking questions, not just sort of answering questions, or, you know, because this is what I have to say, but looking at the world and things that maybe you don't understand or would like to understand, or people's experiences that you don't understand, or exploring your own relationship to the world and the questions that puzzle you. And so that had a big influence on me. I mean, eventually, you know, I first heard about MFA programs when I was an undergrad, thought they seemed very appealing, was sort of self-aware enough to know I wasn't ready for one at the time. I felt like I...
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, even though professors were encouraging, I did have a sense of there's more you need to read, there's more you need to prepare before you go and do an MFA program. So I sort of stumbled into journalism for a while. I was a sports writer, you know, for 6 years in West Michigan, and then took some more workshops, even at the undergraduate institution. Some things worked out. I was in the same area, and at that point, you sort of began to feel more confident about that I could do it. I could go to an MFA program and applied and got in at U of A, Arizona, and got there and did my MFA and then loved it and loved being in a community of writers, loved teaching. I got my first opportunity to teach at U of A. Started to get a sense of my own voice and maybe I could do this as a writer. And then suddenly you're done, you know, and you're like, okay, now you're back out in the real world and not wanting that, wanting to find a way to teach, wanting to find a way to keep writing, adjuncted for a couple semesters and then headed off to do a PhD in Missouri and from Missouri to here.
So what courses, are you going to be teaching any courses in the MFA program itself?
Yeah, I mean, we'll be teaching the fiction workshop is sort of my specialty.
Okay.
But we'll also be teaching, in terms of the creative writers, courses in poetic and narrative theory. So I'll certainly be teaching the narrative theory course at some point, as well as the practicum and publishing course. I mean, one of the potential strengths of our program is the hands-on, pragmatic, working with the press, working with a journal. Getting that experience, that editorial experience, that just the awareness of how sort of books come into being as objects. So it's not just the study of literature, it's not just the writing workshops, but the production side of it as well.
Oh, that's exciting. So you've already started the application process for the students. So have you had a lot of applicants already?
Or? I don't know how you want to define a lot. Not a lot. Our deadline's still coming up on the 15th, and if, you know, knowing students the way I do,
it'll be last minute.
It'll be last minute.
Even
when I was a student applying, I was very aware of when deadlines were, and we do expect that the applicant pool will grow significantly next year, especially in the years to come, and it'll change. And partly mm-hmm. has to do with our national advertising is really just sort of coming out now. We had our first major ad in Writers Chronicle show up this week. We have ads coming in Poets and Writers. I just returned from Chicago and the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Conference, which draws 11,000 writers and all these journals and schools mm-hmm. and programs. So getting the word out nationally, not just to prospective students, but to other professors mm-hmm. who will then go on to recommend that you check out Sam Houston State University, their MFA program. So we expect that to grow, and so we're looking forward. This year feels a little bit like it's going to be, to me, it's a transition year.
Right.
From our, we've had the MA program mm-hmm. here in literature, and it's part of that, a creative writing emphasis. We take a couple workshops, do a smaller thesis.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not sort of coming into this brand new, like we've never done these sorts of things before.
Right.
But we do feel like we're sort of raising the bar for what our expectations will be. It's a 3-year MFA program instead of a 2-year MA program. There are more requirements. We're asking more of them, and we expect that we'll draw a different kind of student, perhaps mm-hmm. a better kind of student as a writer, and hopefully continue to produce students who go on and do good things.
Yeah, I actually got my MA here, mm-hmm. and I had so desperately wanted it to be an MFA. Yeah. I was so upset there was no MFA here.
Yeah,
so I'm excited. Have you had any students decide that they're going to change over from the MA?
We have a couple who are definitely applying, and we've told them. I mean, they're two different processes. It's not like we're just going to take you from the MA program and move you into the MFA program.
Have to reapply.
They have to reapply. And like I said, I know we've got a couple who will be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
The MFA is sort of a bigger commitment in certain senses in terms mm-hmm. of time, but the payoff's a little bit more. I tend to think of the MFA as students being a little more confident about what they want to do. If you're the MA and you're sort of taking the creative writing classes, maybe you're still sort of testing this out. You're also looking at lit. You're thinking about what you might want to do. Your focus might primarily be on sort of strengthening your portfolio for teaching at the high school level, the community college level. The MFA sort of says, there's more. I want to really put the writing at the center mm-hmm. of it. I want to write, and maybe I want to teach at the university level. So there is a sense of because the MFA is terminal, that mm-hmm. it's sort of a bigger step for a writer to take.
So what sort of goals do you have for the students who are coming into the MFA program?
I mean, fundamentally, it seems almost obvious, but is I want them to become published writers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want them, however that sort of defines itself for each of them, but your goal is to get them to produce memorable, important, significant works of art, right? And there's all sorts of other things that come around the profession. It'd be nice for some of them to go on to teaching gigs, right?
Mm-hmm.
To build sort of careers in the writing world, whether it's as editors or publishers or authors or teachers, community arts people, whatever it might be. But I think fundamentally, it's an arts program, it's a creative writing program. Our first goal is to help writers become writers and to publish and to do significant things with their work, be better writers than they were when they came in. And then the rest of the stuff, that's nice too, but you don't just want to produce teachers, you are trying to produce
right.
the artists themselves or help them.
Are you going to push them to publish while they're actually taking classes as well?
To a degree, I mean, that's always, one of my strategies in teaching is to just keep focusing on the work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Keep focusing on the writing, get better as a writer. You do advise and counsel in terms of when you start submitting, right? Whether it's the individual stories and poems to journals, or whether they have a book manuscript that's ready to go, and you try to assist them in terms of knowing what they need to know about pursuing an agent, if that's part of the equation. To help them in this era make decisions between self-publishing, independent publishing, commercial publishing, how do they think about their career, how do they think about their work. You try to give them advice about sort of what expectations they should have for an agent or a publisher. That's sort of the business side of it. But, when I'm in the workshop, I try to get them not to think about those things, because it can be inspiring. It can also be sort of crushing and frustrating, all those rejection letters, and how do you deal with that? And how do you, what's a proper cover letter when you submit a story?
Mm-hmm.
What should you not do? when you have in terms of your relationship with an editor. But fundamentally, I think what you're doing is you're just trying to get them to focus on their work, encourage them, get them to get the work done, give them wise advice about revising and process, and try to be good readers for them on their work. And if you can get them to do that, some of the other stuff will begin to take care of itself. So it, certainly career advice is part of the
program. Right. Yeah. So with students that you have coming in, are you seeing like a lot of new and interesting talent, or
it's a mix, and I mean this is true for any MFA program or graduate program, but in creative writing, you get people who are fresh out of undergrad, mm-hmm. and they've been taking workshops and they're feeling very inspired and driven, and they may be young and raw in their talent, mm-hmm. or maybe even polished to a degree. You get people who, they're middle-aged women who've been in writing groups in the community, in the region, and they want something a little more challenging, a little mm-hmm. more critical. They've been in groups where there's a lot of just sort of patting each other on the back
yeah.
and saying, isn't this wonderful? And they sort of realize themselves that it's maybe not so wonderful,
mm-hmm.
and they need someone to say, well, how do we make it wonderful? How can we be, take a little more, sort of a tough love approach on the mm-hmm. work? You get people who an MFA program who perhaps are already beginning to send stories out, who've published a story or two here or there. They can come from a variety of places in their lives. I got a great piece of advice when I was thinking about MFA programs myself, and a professor, Pinckney Benedict, who said, do the MFA program when it's at the right time of your life for you to do it. And I think that can be a different time of your life for various people. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Students often feel like I got to come right out of undergrad to move into these programs. I think that's not necessarily true for a writer. Sometimes the best thing you can do is don't go straight from undergrad into graduate. Go live a little bit, have some jobs, have some mm-hmm. other aspects of your life. Think of it as material gathering. Read on your own, work on your own, right? And then when it feels like you can get the most out of an MFA program, then go and do that. And whether that's late 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, or right out of undergrad, that's going to depend on the individual student, and you try to, when you're counseling them about these things, try to figure out where they are in their process and what maybe is the next best step for them, and are you the next best step for them as an MFA program.
Now, I've heard this said before, and maybe you can't comment on it, or if you do, we can always delete it from here, but I've heard, and I won't name names, professors just essentially call what the Iowa, program, just another paper mill.
Mm-hmm.
They're just getting students in, and they want you to have been already established, so they have less work to do with you.
Well, yeah, those are sort of two different issues. I mean, the first one is the fear of the paper mill or the elephant machine, as it's often referred to too
I've
in
not
the
heard
book,
it
which
that
is the notion is that it just produces more of the same thing, right?
Okay.
So it keeps itself in business by creating more MFA programs to produce more MFA students. They need to have jobs, so we create more MFA programs that bring in more students, and they publish more books that no one ever reads because they're published by 5,000 small presses. And
right.
And there's a valid criticism to that. And as we've, it's been on my mind, ever since I arrived here and began talking about the possibility of an MFA program, and wanting to be very insistent that we do it for the right reasons and that we do it the right way. And,
mm-hmm.
and the wrong reasons for me are simply as a way to increase enrollment or to bring in tuition dollars and fund the other work that we do. I think you have to be sort of morally and ethically honest with your students about what an MFA program is, what it can do for you,
mm-hmm.
what it might do for you, and what it can't do for you. And I think if you're fair and honest with students about what it is, you're fair and honest with them about funding, if you're fair and honest with them about their job prospects, then it's up to them to make an informed decision. I think
mm-hmm.
it's poor practice on a part of a program that sort of counts on a certain naivete of students, whether they're younger or just not as aware, who they sit in your classroom as an undergraduate perhaps, and they look at you and they're like, I want to do what you do. And you have an MFA, so if I just go get an MFA, then I'll be doing
mm-hmm.
what you do. And as someone who's much more aware of what that job market actually looks like and how difficult it is to get these sorts of positions,
yeah.
it's difficult to explain to them. Right? It's difficult to explain to them how many of your MFA colleagues never went on to publish books, never went on to get these kinds of positions. Not that they have to, but if this is what you're looking at and you think, I want to do that, only a small percentage of people who take the MFA are going to be doing it. But you also don't want to discourage them.
Right.
Because someone's going to be doing this, mm-hmm. and someone's got to have these positions, and even, you know, I try to tell them that the reason why you do an MFA should not be because you want to be a professor like Dr. Kovenin. You should do it because you want 3 years of your life where you get to dedicate yourself to the art and craft of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's your motive, right, then you're going to have a good experience, and it's going to be what you want. If other things come out of it, it's sort of icing on the cake. But if you think it's just, what kind of job can I get with this, then it's probably not the right degree for you. There are jobs that you can get with that can help your career in many ways, some ways not very obvious. But fundamentally, I don't think that's why you pursue an arts degree. Right? You don't do an MFA in dance because you think it's going to get you a job. You do an MFA in dance because you want to be a dancer and you want to have that be a part of your life and who mm-hmm. you are. And, you know, and you are aware of the economic climate. You are aware that people need jobs and careers. And so you just try to be open and honest with them about mm-hmm. What the possibilities are, but also what some of the frustrations can be. You know, I have plenty of friends who are very talented writers who've done impressive things and who are still struggling on a year-by-year basis mm-hmm. to land themselves in a steady position. And, you know, that's just the reality of things. And so it's both, you know, the MFA provides all sorts of opportunities for students, ways of growing as writers, as scholars. It can provide career opportunities, but they need to know coming in, they need to come sort of with eyes wide open. And you're also aware that they will never have their eyes fully wide open until they've been through the process.
Right.
You know, we all do a great job of, when you're at that stage of your life, of sort of thinking, well, I'll be the exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was at Arizona, which at the time was sort of considered a top 10 program, and you know, they've got a long tradition. They produced a lot of tremendous writers have come out of it, both poets and fiction writers. And I remember sitting in a meeting with the department, the creative writing program director at the time, and he said that they'd tracked their graduates, and they realized that 80% of those who took the degree did not go on to continue to write after they'd taken
oh,
the degree.
Wow.
And I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to be a part of that 80%. I've mm-hmm. got to find a way to keep writing. And they said that even among those who would go on to publish a book, the average time between taking the MFA and publication of the first book was 8 years. And, you know, and that sort of,
oh my
gosh. You know, when you think about, you know, how do you make this happen, right? I mean, those just become some of the numbers games that are part of what it is. You know, things continue to shift. And I think, again, somebody who's going to apply the program has to know what their own motives are. You know, do they simply want to have those 3 years of writing and reading and mm-hmm. growing, and that in itself will be sufficient? Do they want to even just self-publish their work eventually,
mm-hmm.
you know, or do they really want to sort of, you know, be an established, significant novelist or poet, and how would they define that for themselves? And that answer is not the same for everybody. You know, some people can afford to take 3 years and out of their lives, and other people are like, look, I'm married, I've got kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's a harder part of
yeah.
the question for me. And I can't answer that for them. I'm not going to tell them and advise them. So here's the things I think you should be thinking about, and then they have to make the decision themselves.
So what do you think about offering online MFAs? Do you think that gives you the same quality?
It doesn't. I mean, you can do things online, and there are programs that do it, and low residency programs that make great use of email and Skype and those sorts of communications. But one of the reasons I wanted this to be full residency, and so why I'm a believer in full residency, is the community that you create. And I think it's harder to create that online. And it's, you know, being in a program, an MFA program, isn't just about being in the classroom. It's about those conversations that take place in the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
It's about where you go after class, right? Class is out, we're heading to dinner, we're heading to the bar, we're going to sit around, we're going to talk
right.
more. It's going to conferences and events together, being around each other, and sort of feeding on each other, and not sort of a carnivorous way, but you know, sort of that you it's that informal learning that
mm-hmm.
takes place in unexpected moments, and that's harder to create online, right? Because
yeah.
it tends to be a formal relationship. That this is the time I'm setting aside to speak with you. This is the time I'm setting aside to give you comments on your work. That's all valuable, but there's something different. There's also something about the dynamic of a face-to-face workshop when you're sitting with a group of 10 or 11 students around a seminar table in the Wind Home, as we use for my classes, my graduate workshops, and you there's just a different atmosphere that says we've all come together for these 3 hours, and there's no distractions, there's
mm-hmm.
no And you often find yourselves in that conversation talking about things that, you know, if I'd written up just with my written comments, you wouldn't have gotten as much.
Right.
We're having this oral conversation. We're having a conversation that involves multiple people, involves multiple perspectives. And, like, you know, can you do that online? There are ways of doing that online, I suppose, but I still think it's different when people are sitting in a room face to face. And I think it's that, you know, one of the things you need as a writer is that sense of community and support, because it's hard. And it's hard when you, to write a good story. It's hard to take that criticism. It's hard to send out your stuff and get those rejections. And it's an inevitable part of the process. So I think that being around each other becomes an important part of what an MFA experience really is.
So how large are the classes going to be for this program?
I mean, they'll be, like most of our grades, they're going to be small, right? I mean, okay. You know, depending on the course and in terms of the, you know, the workshops, you know, I would anticipate anywhere from 8 to 12, 13, 14 students. I mean, the workshop really is the core of the program. You know, an ideal number for the workshop to me is between 10 and 12 students. Right? You don't really want more than that, right? You want people to be able to each speak, contribute to the conversation. Mm-hmm. The larger the classroom gets, the more difficult that is. If it's too small, it puts a lot of pressure on each person.
Right.
You know, you're trying to create an atmosphere in which you know, the author gets to listen to a group of smart, close readers, and empathetic readers talking about their experience of the work and getting those different perspectives. So it's not like you just have sort of, well, here's the one reading we have on the story, so here's what you therefore should go and do with it. But hearing a range of readers sort of give you feedback on the stories is valuable. So you want sort of that nice balance of in terms of size. But yeah, there'll be small, intimate classes where people know everyone very well by the end of it.
Yeah, so are you guys doing having students come in on each semester? That way you're staggering?
We're going to do that at least at the start. We'll take both the applications in the spring for fall enrollment, mm-hmm. applications in the fall for spring enrollment, and then we'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, ultimately my goal would actually be just to do what most sort of more established MFA programs do, which is that you apply, you know, over the winter and into the spring for the coming fall semester, and mm-hmm. you bring in a cohort for the year. But we're going to give it a shot to start to do sort of two application periods. Though, if they want to be considered for a graduate assistantship, that spring application is really where they need to be applying.
Okay.
You know, we're going to essentially give away our money, so to speak, mm-hmm. In the spring for the fall enrollees. I mean, there may be money left over. We'll see. But if, you know, they really—if that's something that's really on their mind—then I would strongly advise applying in the spring semester for the fall.
Okay. So, how many students do you anticipate? Like, is there a cutoff number for you guys?
We don't have a cutoff number,
okay.
Right? And you know, and that's that balance between funding and, you know, how much funding we have. I know sort of a general sense of how much we're going to be able to fund. You know, and that's going to be a handful of students. But we have other students who don't get funding, but they still want to do the program, and they're accepted in. You know, there's not that hard and fast, well, if we hit 15, we just cut you off. But, you know, part of sort of that feeling out process over the first couple of years as we get the program established and sort of set our parameters for, you know, what's big enough and what's too big. So at the moment, there's some flexibility there.
And I'm sure the students, when they apply, they're sending in pieces of the creative work.
Yep.
Are you guys also getting them to do the essay of why do you want to?
We haven't asked that of them. We haven't asked for a personal statement. I mean, the most important thing that we will see in the application is their writing sample, and that will tell us a lot about, you know, are they ready for this. We'll look at their letters of recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
We'll look at their GRE scores, their transcripts. Those sorts of things, but you know, for an MFA program, the main thing we want to know is, do we sense that you have the potential to succeed in our program mm-hmm. as a writer, and the writing sample is the best measure of that. So, you know, it's 20 pages of prose, so for a fiction writer, a creative nonfiction, and then 8 to 10 poems for a poet, and you know, it gets a pretty good sense of where people are in the world.
So, why the GRE? I've seen some MFA programs have gone away from even wanting to look at your GRE scores, so
there's a strong academic component to the program. It's a 48-hour program. They have to take 12 hours of lit classes. They have to take a course in theory, not just narrative and poetic theory, but critical theory. when you they have to take comprehensive exams, just like the MA students in literature.
Okay.
So when you're asking them to do that as well, it's not just coming in and just sort of writing for a little while, but you're asking them to think in terms of their work in writing in a more scholarly fashion. The GRE seems appropriate as one of the measures. It's not a sole measure. I mean, it's a standardized test, and some people do well on them, and some people don't do so well. And so it's one factor in the equation. And certainly, we place more weight on the verbal portion in the writing sample than we do on the quantitative. But you know, and we use the GRE as a benchmark in part, right? We need you to be above this particular line that tells us something about perhaps your preparation or readiness for.
I remember in applying and always wondering when I did get rejection letters, is it because of my writing or was it because of my score?
Yeah.
My quantitative score was abysmal.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you never know. I mean, it's part of the mystery of applying, even when you send in your stories and they get rejected. Like, why? You know, and then why did you take that one? I didn't think that was very good.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so it is a balance, and you just don't know who else is in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is competitive, right? And so there's that measure that you don't know who else is applying and why they're accepted. And then there are other factors. There's sort of I think when you're a faculty member, you're aware of your own biases, right? And what kinds of writer might appeal to you. Is this a realist writer, and is that you want to work with realist fiction writers, or is this someone who's sort of an avant-garde poet who's doing some sort of really funky things, and maybe that'd be really brilliant and wonderful at another school or with another professor, but you think that's not a good fit for
right?
Or it's not a good fit for this program. And I think it's important for people who are applying for graduate programs in general, but also MFA programs in particular, that you're aware of why you're applying to this particular school. Not all programs are the same. All programs have, you look at their faculty and the kind of work they do, and maybe that's not the right person for you, right? I mean, if you're an experimental writer who loves reading, say, David Foster Wallace or John Barth, you need to, and that's the kind of work you want to do, you need to find faculty who are doing that kind of work because they can help you. You know, they'll be the best instructors for you. If you go to a professor who writes these really solid, sort of realist domestic fictions and you want to do this strange stuff, that might not be the right match.
Right.
And that may be a reason why a faculty member would say, I think you're talented, but we're not taking you because I don't think you're the right fit for us.
Mm-hmm.
I know at Mizzou, Marley Swick, who was one of my professors, it wasn't hard after I got there and got to know Marley pretty well to figure out what was so appealing to her about my writing sample and what it said about me as a writer and the kind of writer that she is and the kind of writer that she's drawn to. And so, it says that, she wanted to work with a writer who's doing this kind of work. I sort of fit that year. So it's not just about, talent or where they are, but it's, are you a good fit for what we're doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Do we match well?
So what do you think about, I don't know, I always wish that someone would give feedback at that level after they've just rejected you. I don't know if it's
hard because, it would get so...
Because you get so many applications.
You get so many applications, but you also get certain applications where the best advice would be is, I just don't know why you're even thinking about this. And you never want to have that conversation, especially if you have no real relationship with a student. It's hard enough for me to rein in a student, I've worked with them for a while, and I just know, or at least I feel, and that's hard, too, because you never know. I always tell students, you never know when a student's going to make that leap, and so I'm hesitant, again, it's just about being honest with them about their work and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We had a student a couple of years ago who's gone on to do really good things, and I first saw her work, and she was talking about wanting to do an MFA program. She was in the MA program, and I thought, oh, geez. And then I had her in a workshop and went through a semester where each story just made these leaps.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time she turned in her third one late in the semester, it was wonderful. I turned to her in the workshop and I said, this is really coming along. This is a potentially publishable piece. It's not a great piece. It's not a brilliant piece. It's not blowing with all the water.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see her abilities with the craft really grow. And then she's gone to another MFA program elsewhere. And So you don't know when it's going to happen. So I think you have to be conscious as a professor when you're working with students who are sort of still early in their career, still trying to find their voice, still trying to find their footing, that you don't crush that, you don't discourage that. And so it can be a delicate balance, even though you may sometimes have that sense of, and you do sometimes, right, that I don't think this is really for you, but apply, right? If you're interested, apply, do the work, keep writing, and rejection is going to be an inevitable part of it, and then you sort of have to decide how is it going to fit into your life, right? And you have to decide how long, you know, if you want to be in an MFA program and year after year you keep getting rejected by every program, do you eventually just say enough, or do you just are you tenacious enough to keep working on your own until you can get yourself into one of those programs and have that experience, even if you're never going to go on ultimately to be sort of a published author, or whatever it might be. So
when you were mentioning, you know, the fit of the student into the program, I noticed, and maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but when I first went into programs or workshops, I really wasn't reading as much as I was writing. And do you see that with students, that they seem to think that they know what's out there, but they haven't really read much of anything?
Yeah, I mean, we have far more writers. If you hang around MFA programs long enough, or even undergraduate creative writing classes, especially undergraduate, you find that we have far more people who want to be writers than people who want to read. And for a writer, I mean, that's just that's a fatal error. I mean, you learn to write largely from reading, right? Things that are modeled for you, things that you're, some things you're consciously aware of when you're reading that way, but things that you're very unconsciously aware of. You know, students, you know, more and more, now I'm going to sound like an old fogey here, but you know, the role of TV in shaping my generation and TV generation's sense of narrative and what belongs in a story, and yet TV is a very different medium than, say, the novel or a poem. And yet you see the influence in terms of melodrama, in terms of plot, and in terms of the things that students end up bringing into their workshop and especially into their early writing. And you just keep trying to funnel books to them, you know, and say, you know, if you're interested in this, try this. If you haven't read something like this, try that. And if the student's really resistant to that, right, they've got their few kinds of books that they like to read, and that's a sign for me, right, that you're not open enough to this. You're not ambitious enough. When I was an undergraduate, man, when professors name-dropped the book or mentioned a title, man, it got written down, and I was tracking it down. It wasn't about me telling my professors, well, here's what I've been reading, and you should go read it too. You know, it was about trying to listen to them, and because I wanted to be like them, and then going out and doing it. And the best, one of the best signs for me with students, it's not just the writing they're doing, but it's their ambition as readers, that they want to be exposed to more, because the more they're exposed to, the more potential they have, right, in terms of figuring out what it is that they want to do, and what's their voice going to be like, and what's going to be their unique space that they carve out, that, you know, when we read their work down the road, we go, that's a Michelle Martinez piece, and you know it's a Michelle Martinez. It's not like anybody else, right? It may remind us of certain other writers, but it's clearly her work. And it's not just derivative, it's not just the latest Twilight, it's not just a variation on vampires and werewolves, but she's found her own way of looking at the world that's distinct, and it comes through in her storytelling. So you're trying to get students to read and read, and that means not just contemporary stuff, but clearly trying to get them to read good contemporary fiction, but getting them to read in I think it was the tradition, right? Why should you read the writers from the early 20th century? Why should you read Wolfe? Why should you read Hemingway? Why should you read Fitzgerald? Why should you read Ellison? 19th century, right? Why should you have read Austen and Melville and Whitman and Dickinson and other people that, you know, aren't even canonical? But, you know, how do you get them to explore? And that becomes overwhelming, because you very quickly realize that you haven't read very much. And I tell my students, you're always going to feel that way. I don't care how much you've read, you're still going to feel like, I'm under-read. I haven't read those people, and I should read those people. And you're in a conversation, and you realize someone's talking about this Brazilian writer that everyone seems to know, and you're like, okay, I never even heard of them. How did I miss that, right? And they have 20 books, and then, so I need to go do that. But that's part of the pleasure. You never run out of that material, right? It becomes a lifelong pursued becomes a part of your identity as a writer and as a person, that you read, that literature plays this role in your life, and you're constantly searching out, you know, new writers who found ways to articulate something about the human experience, mm-hmm. right? And which I think fundamentally is what writing and what art is about. And you're trying to find your own way to articulate that and say right. that in your own unique way. But you kind of have to know how it's already been done. You know, students are, you know, I'm always struck in workshops, especially again undergraduate workshops, where students will say something about, this is so unique, I've never seen anything like this before. And I'm like, I see it every semester. Mm-hmm. I see this exact story every semester. I see this exact move. We were talking about it again last night. Eye color giving away. That's how we knew who the killer was. Oh, I've never seen that before.
That drives me nuts.
You know, I saw her, and I saw her eyes, and I fell in love with her right then because of her eyes. And I'm mm-hmm. like, if I see eyes like that, I'm going to shoot myself in the head. It's like, and students saying, this is so unique. And I'm like, no, I have seen it every semester. And why? Because I read a lot more than you have. I read a lot more of your graduate workshop stories than you have, or graduate workshop stories. But also just that you've read, you know, you've watched other writers find other ways to communicate things, mm-hmm. and that's partly what you're trying to do as a writer. You know, it's the same old stories, we've always told, you know, love and heartbreak and marriage and family and God and ethics and how do we make these decisions, and those stories don't change, but you're always trying to find a new way to tell that story, mm-hmm. and those are the writers who interest me most, who are finding ways to say it new. I mean, to go back to the modernist, you know, mantra, that's her pound, make it new. And I mm-hmm. still think that legacy holds, right? That's what writers are. I'm just trying to do what's already been done or repeat what's already been said. But you're trying to say new things or find new ways to say the same things we've always been saying.
So how do you feel, based off of that, about people who end up retelling some of the old stories in a new voice, like someone who adapts old fairy tales?
It's clearly... you know, one of the, I think, dominant features of the current sort of era, right, is going back, you know, reinventing, you know, and fairy tales are a great example of that. You know, writers like Angela Carter, writers like Kate Bernheimer, you know, who are going back to the old fairy tale, and looking at, not in a Disney-fied way, mm-hmm. but sort of turning them upside down. I think one of the markers right now, this is a reflection of the internet, the era of the mashup.
Right.
Even these questions of authorship, and is this mine, and how can I take other people's works and reinvent them in a certain way, or and incorporate them in the way that sampling works in music. You know, how does that work in literature? And so for whatever reason right now, I mean, there's a real sort of power to them. There's a real sort of appeal to taking those old things and finding ways to recombine them, to mash them up, to take things from two different or three different genres and smash them together and sort of see what happens. And that's part of the excitement. Again, it's trying to find, you know, how do you tell a story of boy meets girl in a way that doesn't make us go, well, once again, just another story of boy uh-huh. meets girl. But how do you, you know, find forms and find ways to sort of make us see that in the way we have it or think about it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get through to the students who are all about, no, this is unique, what do you mean this has been done a million times before? I mean, how do you get through to them when they clearly haven't been interested or motivated enough on their own to read more?
I mean, sometimes you just say that. I mean, This is really, maybe it's even really interesting, but you know, I've had that experience a couple times in workshops. Where, like, this is really interesting. It's so, anyone who's read, who's going to read this, is going to just think this is a knockoff of so and so. And there is that, I think there's that mode in your writing life, that apprentice mode, where I think that's actually quite all right, right? That you try
to
write,
copy the masters.
You try to write a Raymond Carver story, mm-hmm. right? And you end up sounding like a knockoff of Raymond Carver. You know, because, you know, Cormac McCarthy sort of looms large, and especially in our department, but with, you know, with a lot of our students, like, you know, they can't get away from it. You can tell that they've been reading Cormac McCarthy. You can tell they've been in Gene Young's classes and they've been talking about it, and I think that's okay. You know, and it's okay. You know, I'll say it's Catherine Mansfield, I think it's the right name, who, you know, learned by copying out the stories of Chekhov and then trying to sort of move the time and place but keeping the structures. I think there's real benefit to that, mm-hmm. right? It's okay to write your knockoff David, you know, Foster Wallace story, But at some point, if you're going to really be a writer and have your own voice, you have to move beyond that, right? And I think, you know, a lot of writers do, they sort of begin in that apprentice phase where you can tell who they've been reading, and they're trying, they're still trying on their, you know, to find their own sort of look, their own fashion. And that time will come if they keep doing that. And so I think it's okay for that apprenticeship to be there, but you don't want them to stop and just sort of say, you know, I'm just imitating these other writers, because that's not your goal. Your goal is not to be a second-rate Raymond Carver. Your goal is to be, you know,
first-rate whoever you are.
First-rate whoever you are, right, yeah.
That brings to mind so many books that I've come across lately that just are painful. It's like, okay, could we have ripped off Tolkien any harder than you just did?
And it's marketing. Right? I mean, there's part of that. You know, that in the practicum and publishing class, we talk about tensions between art and commerce, right? Between culture and commerce, and you know, so many of the books that come to our attention in a public sphere are not necessarily coming to our attention because of their artistic value or what they have to say about the human experience. Because marketers have figured out, you know, what people want and how do we keep giving them more of what they want. And you know, we're talking about in the context of book design and covers and Twilight and how quickly all these, you walk into a store and all these young adult novels that have covers that very closely resemble Twilight. It's not even just that their content resembles, but even just the design is made to say, if you like that, then you will also like this. And, you know, so... Yeah, you sort of have to ask students, you know, who do you want to be as a writer? You know, do you just want to sort of write imitations and then knockoffs, or do you have bigger ambitions than that? And it's sometimes a disconnect opens up between me and a few of my students, because I never had as a kid a desire to sort of be the second rate of this or to write imitations. I really had a sense of I want to find a way to tell my own stories that are distinct, and so you know, my motives have always been sort of in that direction. Which is not to say that my work doesn't bear relationship to other work, but it just wasn't a motive. But clearly, that's not. I mean, fan fiction is one of the biggest growing, you know, sort of things that people enjoy doing in the online world, and the notion of taking other people's characters and then writing my own sort of story just never appeals to me. And so I'm like, I don't get it. I know some of you really love this. I don't get it, but you know, good for you. But you know, it says something about my own drives as a writer and not wanting to just take other people's characters and sort of weave my own tales, but wanting to have my own characters who are mine. And these are characters I've developed, I've lived with. You know, in my head, they're distinctly mine. Ego, maybe.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. But I'm also thinking of. And I can't think of an instance for myself, but I know I have in general, where I see a story that's not particularly well written, but the characters have promise, and it's like, ooh, if you could just give them to me, I could make them really do something spectacular.
There is that impulse as a teacher, too, when you see students who have, you know, the nugget is there, the idea is there, and you're sort of aware, but this is a student who will never actually get that story to where it could be. But then, you know, part of it is, you know, having that conversation. The graduate workshop last night, I had two MA students who were really workshopping for the first time ever, the first time they've ever really had to write a story and bring it to conclusion. And you know, I was just so pleased with them last night. You know, you're always worried. I have several students in there who've been through undergraduate workshops with me. They know they know how it works. You can see where they've sort of developed as writers over the last couple of years, last few years. And then you have these sort of newbies, and you're sort of nervous about how are they going to sort of fit in with that conversation. And what I was, I think, particularly thrilled about was the potential that you saw in what they were trying to do. Both the stories themselves, the current stages, which are still in process, are a mess. You know, lots of things that don't belong there. But part of the conversation was helping them realize, here's where the real heart of your story is. Right? If you can come tell this story... and find a way to do it, you may have something here. And being able to do that, right, and to encourage them, to both help them see why the current draft is just not working and why it is a mess, but that's okay. that's the workshop is part of the process. This class is part of the process. This mm-hmm. is not the one semester in which you did this. This is about trying to help you take that next step as a writer, mm-hmm. regardless of where you are. And for some writers in the workshop, that may be you are getting stuff, you're at the point where we're about ready to start sending stuff out for you, right, and trying to find, you know, publications for you, places to publish. Some of you, that may be a few years down the road yet. You're still trying to get your handle on, you know, just character development or a plot that holds tension and mm-hmm. pulls the reader through, or you're still trying to develop your capacity with language or finding metaphor, right, for finding similes or figurative language, and that's okay. I mean, you'll be doing that for the rest of your life if you keep writing. Mm-hmm. But you know, the responsibility of the professor in the classroom is to sort of identify, you know, where is the student at right now in their work? Where is this particular individual story at? And what do they need to hear about it? And what's going to be most helpful to them right now? And you just keep moving them along that road, mm-hmm. hopefully, and keep giving them the tools, helping them develop the tools to pursue writing in whatever ways they want it to fit into their lives.
So do you and... Oh, I don't know if you can really speak for the other faculty members that are going to be in the MFA program, but do you still do or join other workshops? So are you still working on your own writing?
I'm certainly working on my own writing. I don't, you know.
So who's your community then?
Who me. Do you? you know, it's one of the things I'm not very good at. It's funny, because I just sent the novel to a friend. So I have a few friends who will look at my stuff mm-hmm. and provide feedback. It's difficult because you realize, you know, as someone who's got, you know, a novel that's done and a couple of new books in the works, it's a lot to ask someone to hand them a 395-page manuscript.
Could you read this? Yeah.
Can you read this? You know, I don't know what you're doing this weekend, but could you give me like line-by-line feedback? If you could give uh-huh. me some comments at each chapters, and you're aware that they have their own lives. You know, it's teaching, it's family, it's mm-hmm. their own writing. It's a lot to ask someone to do that, and I've always been very aware of that. And, but people can be very generous and sort of surprising, you know, in the ways that they're very generous about it. And so I haven't been very good about taking advantage of that mm-hmm. in the way that I know, you know, having come back from the conference and talking with friends who, especially poets, who exchange lots of work with each other constantly still postgraduate work. We, you know, they developed relationships in graduate school and they continue to do so. That's one of the benefits of MFA programs. You develop these lifelong friendships. And it's not just friendships, but you develop lifelong readers, which mm-hmm. may be just one or two people, but you find people who, for the rest of your life, they become your first readers, and they give you that feedback. And you know, I tell students, this is the benefits of being either the undergraduate level or the graduate level. It's a rare time in your life when people will pay close attention to your work and give you critical feedback. It's convenient and nice. We have to. It's part of the requirements of the class, right? They're mm-hmm. getting a grade. I'm paying attention not just to their writing, but to their feedback they give to each other, both orally and written. Once you leave that environment, it's a lot harder to find that, right? You can turn to your spouse or your significant other and say, can you read this?
That's nice, dear.
It's a different relationship. They have a different investment in you. I tell students about how I learned this lesson the hard way. An undergraduate, and I had a girlfriend, and she was a freshman, and I was a junior, and she asked me to look over her freshman comp paper for her and give her some feedback, and I, being the good future professor and creative writer, did exactly what she asked me to do, which is take a red pen and go through it line by line and give her lots of feedback.
That's not what she wanted.
And I handed it back to her. I still remember standing in her dorm room and looking at it and just starting to cry and going, why did you write all this stuff over my paper? And I hit myself, you know, I slap myself on the head, like, you idiot, you idiot, you idiot, you idiot. and I turned to the class, like, what was she asking for right there? And, like, she wanted you to say it was really good. Yeah. And fix the comma splice on page 17, but it's wonderful. And yeah. She wanted me to be a boyfriend at that moment, and I didn't know that. And I said, that's the problem. Once you leave this environment, your friends have a different relationship to you. They want to be your friend, and so they don't want to say, this is really terrible, and you should maybe go into another line of business. and they just don't have the time, or they don't have the skill set. Mm-hmm. Right? They haven't been in workshops. They don't even know exactly what they're supposed to be looking for,
right.
Or how to give you the kind of feedback that's actually going to be helpful to you. You know, and you may join a writing group through the library, but again, you get people at all sorts of levels, and you get, you know, sometimes people luck into really good groups that way, mm-hmm. but sometimes that can be really, really hard to find. So take advantage of it while you're in a program, either at the undergraduate level or the graduate level. Develop those relationships so that when you're down the road 5-10 years, you still have mm-hmm. those people that you can go to and get that feedback. Even though it'll be harder because you don't have a structure and people have lives and they're trying to do all their things, but I mean, that is what you want.
Yeah. So what about the craft of poetry or storytelling? Do you find that students are even more reticent to learn the actual structure, the actual bare bones of, you know, what makes a metaphor and how it works? And
well, they if they come into the workshop, that's what they're going to find out, right? I mean, you're trying to give them, impart a language to talk about writing. You know, this, even for those who haven't been through the workshop, you know, this is why I think you can, I always tell students, you're further along as a reader than you are as a writer. So your ability to recognize that this isn't working in someone else's work, you know, is usually well ahead of where your ability to do yourself. So mm-hmm. even with undergraduates, you know, with the beginning creative writing workshop, even though none of them may be very far along as writers, they've been reading for a long time. They've been watching movies. They've been watching TV mm-hmm. shows. They have a sense of, they know when they're bored. They right. know when that seems really irrelevant. They know when this seems hokey. They know when that seems like just a little, you know, pulling the rug out from another reader. Mm-hmm. They know when this is cliche because they've seen it 1,000 times before. They know when they're interested and invested. So you can begin having conversations, simply begin at that level, right? And then you try to help them to go, okay, why? Can we done? Okay, you're saying you were just bored all the way through, that you didn't care about the character, mm-hmm. right? Why didn't you care about the character? And a good workshop leader can sort of ask those right questions to get not just the, well, I liked it or I didn't like it, which is not helpful at all to the writer. Let's try to identify why. Mm-hmm. Right? And you say, I found the character repulsive. Well, can we talk about why you found the character repulsive? And can the character still be repulsive and yet have him or her be interesting enough mm-hmm. to keep reading? So the craft discussions begin to come out of that, right? And you know, writers have to become just interested in that, right? And you know, if you're a poet, I mean, you have to become interested in what it means to write a villanelle. Right, mm-hmm. what it means to write a sestina, what it means to work in form, right, what it means to work in free verse. And they sort of have to want to. And if they don't, then they're probably not the right match for a program. Right? Mm-hmm. They're probably not the right match for this sort of approach to writing. If they sort of want to just have fun and not ask questions, then I don't think they really should be or want to be.
Right. So for the students who aren't maybe quite ready yet to apply, how would you encourage them?
I had a couple conversations not very long ago to come up for our current undergraduates who are not English majors. They've never been in workshops. They're in other departments, but they're really interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we had good, honest conversations, and where what we came out of it was, why don't you take an undergraduate workshop in the fall, right, or the summer, depending on how their schedule work out, and get a taste for it. And see, and you may go, oh my word, this is the best thing I've ever encountered. Yeah, I want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You may go, oh wow, I'm over my head. Mm-hmm. I need to do more other stuff, you know, either undergraduate workshops or just more reading and writing on my own before I do this. See what it's like. I had one of the women in my current MA graduate workshop was very interested in the program we talked in the fall, but she wanted to get a taste of it. Mm-hmm. So she enrolled in the for the MA workshop this mm-hmm. semester as a non-degree seeking student. You know, she's applying for the program now, and she's had the, you know, she had enough time, even these 7 or 8 weeks we've had so mm-hmm. far, to get a taste for it and go, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is exactly what I'm looking for. So we've had conversations in the fall through the early part of the spring, and she's definitely going to apply for the MFA program. But she gave herself an opportunity to get a taste for it, to know, is this the right thing for me? If there's students who've come through our undergraduate English program and they've had experiences in workshops, they probably have a good sense of what they're getting into. Mm-hmm. I mean, you never have a full sense of that until you're in it. I mean, graduate life is different than undergraduate life. But at least they have a good sense of how workshops are going to work, what's going to be asked of them. But not everyone who's writing or who wants to be a writer has had that experience yet. And so they're interested in the MFA program, but you want to make sure that they know what the rigor is going to be, what the tone is going to be, how workshops function, you know, what it's going to mean to be sitting in that theory class, you know, and are they ready for that too? Right? Mm-hmm. Do they want the academic aspect? It is an academic program, and not everyone, you know, who wants to write wants to be a part of the academic environment. Right? They'd rather just have a writing group or people who are reading and writing, but they're not being asked to do the things that we ask of you in an academic program. And so, again, that's about fit. MFA programs aren't for everyone, but for those to whom that appeals, you know, to be in the workshops, to have those literature requirements, to think about writing in a scholarly fashion, to think about your own work in a scholarly fashion, that becomes the right environment for those writers.
So what do you recommend for, like, for, I guess, non-traditional students, or I guess students?
I would say MFA, it's all non-traditional. There's no such thing as a traditional student.
Okay.
Right? I mean, you know, when I was in my MFA program, we had a couple students who were right out of undergrad. A lot of us were sort of in our late 20s. There were people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, people who had other careers, had MBAs, had full-time jobs, and then left it to come do an MFA program. There's an older woman who was in her 50s who'd raised, I don't know how many kids, sort of in the backwoods of Kentucky, who'd finally gotten the space, kids were all grown, and she's like, I'm going to go do an MFA. So you get a real range of students. So that model of, I tell students, this is not like you come out of undergrad and you go to law school, you go to med school, these sort of professional training programs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The MFA is an arts degree. And it's not like dance anymore. Maybe you think I need to do this a certain time of life
right.
If my knees are shot. you know, you do it when it's right for you. So
mm-hmm.
In that sense, there isn't a traditional MFA student. Right? I think you're looking for someone who, this is just the time of their life when they're ready to do this.
Yeah, no, it does. I'm thinking also of, like, because you mentioned the people who've had careers. So you really have to dedicate, full time to this? You can't.
If you're going to do it right, I mean, I think that's what you're looking at doing. And it's always a challenge, right? I mean, if you're not, and this is that why funding becomes so important, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to fund students so they're not having to work full-time, right, and commute in and then commute back. You know, when you're talking about a three-year program and everything you're going to ask of them and everything that they're going to ask of themselves, right, you want to be able to give yourself that opportunity. So it is a challenge. Again, it's one of those questions that they have to ask, right? If you're going, you know, how do you balance that? And it's not like it gets easier. I tell students too. If you're going to be a writer, that's always going to be a part of your life. Right? I mean, how do you balance family commitments, community commitments, job commitments with carving out the space in which you write your novels and you write your poems? So it won't change. But when you're in the MFA program, it does feel like this is a time in your life where you try to carve out that space
mm-hmm.
very intentionally and give yourself structure. You're given structure because we're going to ask you, you're going to be in these classes, and you have
right.
deadlines, we're going to ask you to do these things. And I think that's really, really beneficial. But then it ultimately becomes on the writer to develop their own discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can be in the program and you cannot do those things. Right? And then maybe the experience won't be worth it for you. But I mean, it is a challenge. Right? People have to think about how this fits in their lives and why they want it, and have to be motivated enough to really do it.
Okay, so tell me, what are you reading right now? Are you reading anything creative, non-creative?
A couple of things to see. I've been on a real Russian kick for the last couple of years.
Probably, everyone goes on a Russian kick at some point.
Well, I realized, you know, it's one of the things where you realize you get to a certain age and everyone assumed that you read all those books,
mm-hmm.
And I realized that I didn't. I hadn't, and you know, so Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Chekhov and Gogol and that whole, you know, and I find them, I guess, significant in a lot of ways, and writing about subject matter that appeals greatly to me. These questions of faith and politics and family and all that thing, that stuff gets intertwined. So I think they're still very relevant
mm-hmm.
Even today. And I just started a collection of stories I picked up the other day, Jack Driscoll, who's a Michigan writer. And the weird thing was, I was reading it on the plane back from the conference, and the third story is set in Huntsville and the death row, which I did not anticipate. The first two stories are Michigan stories, and I was taking a great pleasure in reading about my home state and recognizing places and environments. And then I get to the third one, I started reading, like, oh my word, and he doesn't say Huntsville, but it's mm-hmm. Lake, Texas, and it's an execution, the execution chamber, and I'm like, it's Huntsville, and I'm trying to identify exactly mm-hmm. where the town what he's referencing, and it's not a writer I've read before, I was recommended to a friend by at the conference, another Michigan poet, and I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the collection. So those are the immediate books that are on my shelf. I've been reading, Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago, I've been mm-hmm. reading that. That's my current Russian novel that's I'm almost through. So those are my present reads.
Have you ever read Moby Dick?
Yes.
What did you think?
I love Moby Dick.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite all-time novels. And
when did you read it?
I read it in grad school. I didn't read it to my PhD program. It's one of those books that you find yourself in a PhD program in English, and everyone assumes that we've all read Moby Dick, and I hadn't. And in certain books, it's sort of strange what can happen with canonical works, especially in the since the 80s and 90s, when we see a real shift and an opening up of mm-hmm. the canon, that a lot of those dead white male writers just assume that we all read them, and then you realize, no, we didn't, because mm-hmm. everything was shifting, and the push mm-hmm. was away from reading canonical authors. And so I felt very embarrassed about that, having a conversation with a professor. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up reading Moby Dick alongside one of my classes. And, you know, Melville's, he's not for everyone, that's for sure. But he's one of those writers who, he's vital because he's asking the big questions, you know, about man and God and fate and who are we and obsession and drives and, you know, there are certain sections I'm sure everyone gets bored with, but I like authors who go after the big questions. I'm not very interested in sort of the quotidian questions that aren't really going to matter in 5 or 10 years. So those authors who can ask questions that, you know, you feel like you read him all these years later and mm-hmm. he still has something to say. You know, he's doing what Chekhov. You know, Chekhov has a saying that the role of the artist is not to answer the question, but it's to pose the question in exactly the right way.
And I
sort of think, you know, authors like Melville, authors like Dostoevsky, that's what they do. They don't necessarily, they don't resolve the tension of life, mm-hmm. but they ask the question in such a way that you sort of say, yeah. And that's the tragic beauty of life, right? That you can't resolve that tension. There isn't an easy answer to that question. And those are the things that keep us awake at night. You know, and realizing that other people are asking those questions. But those questions have always been asked. They were asked in the 19th century, they were asked in the 5th century, they were asked, you know, since the dawn of man, right? That how do we, you know, why are we here? How do you behave ethically towards one another? What are my commitments and obligations mm-hmm. to the people closest to me? How do I make a living? What's it all about? How do I deal with grief and loss? And when you have authors who are finding ways to ask those questions or pose those questions and get at what that experience is like, then I feel like I feel some connection mm-hmm. here. I feel like it means to be human. I feel like you're still speaking to me, you know, somehow over all these years. And certainly different writers will do that for different people. And I think part of what you do as a reader is you find who those voices mm-hmm. are. And yeah, so that's me and Moby. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's great. So I really hope that this MFA program really takes off. And maybe we can do another interview sometime after it's been a little bit more established and see where you're at.
When things are so crazy and we're so busy flying around the country bringing in writers. And
that's right.
How can I fit you into the schedule? We'll see how I can do it. But yeah, I mean, we're excited about the program. We're excited about the new opportunities that it's going to create. We're excited about our new hire. Nick Lance is a poet who's going to be coming to join us. We're very excited about that, expanding the program. Adding to our sort of aesthetic and sort of mm-hmm. what we have to present. So it's a good time to be at SAM. It's a good time for the program, and we're very much looking forward to
I'm excited. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.